Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Helen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is a guest I'm really looking forward to speaking with, is Mary Helen Sanders, Executive Science Officer, just about to step down from that role with ISAP. So you've been there since the beginning, Mary Helen. And what we want to do today is just talk to you about some of your memories, I guess, of ISAP and some of the achievements of ISAP.
Great. It's nice to be here.
You did your PhD with Todd Kleinhammer. And Right. Obviously Todd is a hero of anyone who's associated with ISAP. And then I guess you forged a kind of a different career path. I mean, the standard career path is into academia or into industry. And but you forged your own path. Do you want to, can you tell us something about that, how that came about and why it came about?
Yeah, I wish I could say it was some grand plan that I executed, but of course it was all a matter of serendipity. I did go into industry as an industrial scientist for about 6 years, I think, with Miles Laboratories at the time. And then because personal things started to happen, my husband's job was going to change. He came home, I think it was prior to a Memorial Day weekend, saying that he just heard that they were going to close the Indiana office down. And I had heard essentially the same day that they were doing the same thing for us. And so I was going to have to relocate to Madison and he was going to have to relocate somewhere else. And so the question just came up is, what do we do as a family? And he had a great job offer out in Colorado, and Colorado was a place that we were happy to move to. So we moved as a family out to Colorado at that point. And I didn't really have anything sorted out professionally for myself at that time, but I was pregnant with my second child. And I thought, well, it's not a bad time to take a moment to think things through. So then I just started consulting and working on my own. And then this idea of ISAP came up and it just kind of evolved from there.
And of course, back then, it was a while ago, you couldn't do the remote stuff. I mean, there wasn't the Zooms and the Teams and even probably, the kind of email contact that we have now. And so how did you get going? I mean, how did you just reach out to industry? Did they know you by reputation? How did that happen?
You know, again, it was so serendipitous. I had a longstanding relationship with Joe O'Donnell, who was the executive director of the California Dairy Research Foundation at the time. And Joe and I had worked together on a few things. And Joe, of course, was worked closely with Todd as well. And Joe asked me, he knew that I kind of was in a situation where I wasn't working full time for anybody. And he just said, would you be willing to review the literature on probiotics, write an article for us, and, you know, try to tell us where we stand today in terms of the science? And I agreed to do that. And it was this really long article. I am a little embarrassed by it now because I think, you know, it's always so much better to get in and get out and make a few short points. But I spent a ton of time digging into the available literature. And of course, at the time, there just weren't that many published clinical trials. I mean, we're talking, 1990, I guess. Maybe that article had a 1993 publication date. But anyway, there just wasn't much there. But it really just opened up the door to this whole probiotic area for me. And then after that, because there just weren't that many people in the U.S. that were into probiotics, companies just found me if they needed, you know, someone to come in and answer some questions for them. So I owe a lot to Joe for that.
Yeah, I remember Joe. He's a wonderful guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, ISAP obviously became a big part of your life from that point on. And what's your favorite memory or favorite thing about ISAP, about being part of ISAP?
Well, you know, the whole role that I played in ISAP really evolved over the years. And it's just so much more substantial today than it was when we first started this. But really, all along, I mean, you have to say that number one is that we just had great scientific discussions. I mean, people would bring up points, and it's one thing to read the literature. It's another thing to have an opportunity to sit and really talk to people saying, you know, what's at the heart of this? And, you know, what needs to happen to, you know, for something good to come out of the direction that this field is going. And I think that those conversations were really great. But I think in addition to that, for me, and I think that this really helped me grow as a scientist tremendously, was I had access to an incredible board of directors. I mean, we had what, at any given time, Colin, maybe what, 8, 9, 10 of like top people in the field who cared. And these people really, you know, they were there to facilitate. They were there to do what they could do. And I could go to any number of them and just say, hey, I don't get this. I don't know what's going on. You know, what do you think we need to do here? And I could bounce it off one and then bounce it off another. And we could talk as a group. And you're right, not on Zoom, but by email mostly. And I think that that was just a tremendous resource. And I just benefited tremendously from it. And I think ISAP has as well.
Yeah, but that takes the kind of extraordinary gifts that you have, Mary Ellen, to actually be able to communicate with a lot of extraordinary scientists and do it efficiently, and where you win the goodwill, I think, of people that are willing to devote a lot of effort into getting an organization going. Can you talk to us about some of your favorite conversations at an ISAP meeting or in talking to the board?
Yeah, and this is one, Dan, I'm going to embarrass you with, because I think one of my favorite conversations I had was when I was talking to you about statistics, and we were sitting on a bus, and I don't remember where we were going. I don't remember what meeting we were at, but we were sitting on a bus, and I remember looking over the back of it, of my chair, talking to you, because you were in the seat behind me, and I was talking to you about statistics and how I didn't quite get it and everything, and you just looked at me, and you just said, you know, Mary Ellen, the role of statistics is to find out the truth behind the science. And you just stopped there. And I thought, that is just like the most outstanding thing I've heard for a long time. I mean, you know, people like to rag on statistics. Now you can get it to say whatever you want it to say. But I just love the fact that that was from your heart, from a specialist who understood the field. And you were just so eloquently and simply stated, like, the goal is to find the truth. It's not to like get it the data to say something we want it to say. It's to find the truth. And I just love that. That's one of my all-time favorites.
The only problem is, as statisticians, we always say our estimates of the truth have a lot of uncertainty in them. So we always want to put uncertainty intervals around it. But yeah, that should be the goal, I think, of every scientist.
Yeah, I agree.
And what always impressed me, Mary Ellen, in all my dealings with you was, you know, maybe this is advice you could give to somebody entering a non-standard academic field or something. You didn't come to people and ask them their opinion. You didn't come to people and say, tell me what it is. You came already armed. You know, you'd already read the papers. You obviously, you know, had the intellect and ability to do anything you wanted in science. And you chose this route. And I think that's a bit different. Some consultants feel like their job is to put people together, but not really get in between or argue the point. How important do you think it is that you do know the science for this kind of career?
Well, certainly with ISAP, I think that I did bring together this balance of understanding the science, but also being willing to kind of roll my sleeves up and play the executive role as well. And I think that's kind of hard to, that's a tough balancing act in some respects. But I think the reason I may have come armed, and that's an interesting way to put it, Colin, but I had a tremendous respect for the board, for ISAP. I mean, all of these people. And I never forgot that everyone there was there as a volunteer. I mean, no one in ISAP, on the ISAP board, did it for notoriety or any kind of financial or personal gain beyond just what they would, you know, want to be able to walk away with from knowing that they helped out. I mean, that's really what everybody got from this. And so I tried to really respect the time and the, you know, what I would ask of the board. So I'm not saying I didn't ask casual questions and people would be happy to answer them, but I did try to say, okay, I'm going to do what I can do, and then I'm going to bring the board in and then have them fill in, you know, what it is that I'm not able to do. So I did try to do as much of the groundwork on projects as I could do, and my scientific background, I think, allowed me to do that.
Did you ever, this may be an odd way of putting it, did you ever lose faith in probiotics and prebiotics? Or did you ever really wonder, is this real, you know, or is it going to stand the test of time, or were you always confident that this was a robust and valid scientific field?
Yeah, I don't think I never really had belief in it, you know, so I've always considered belief as something that you say for people and for religion, I guess, or for God. Like, I think it, you know, and people like Dan on the board have always encouraged this as, you know, just, well, and Dan Merenstein also has been one that has really led me down this path, as you really just say, well, what does the evidence say? And, you know, and I think that we've always hoped within ISAP, if tomorrow, you know, landmark studies came out saying that this is just all bogus and there's nothing there, that we would turn the lights off and say, well, it was a good run and we gave it a go. But I guess we know better now, right?
Yeah, that's what I've always appreciated about Mary Ellen. It's not just making executive decisions. It's when you've been in interviews and outreach and people ask you more or less to tout probiotics or whether or not they should be touted, you're very confident in describing when there is or isn't evidence, and you're not afraid to say what the shortcomings are as well as what the advantages of the evidence are. And so I think that requires like a tremendous amount of confidence in your scientific ability and your ability to stand up to people and tell them where, you know, where there are shortcomings and what their evidence is.
Well, you lose all credibility if you can't do that, you know, then the next thing you say, nobody believes. So you might as well just, as you say, Dan, you know, you search as close as you can get to the truth and go with that.
Yeah, no, I think we can say by now that the hypothesis, and science is always hypothesis driven, that prebiotics and probiotics really do benefit human health. So that's about all we can ever say. You're right. The next experiment might prove us all wrong, but we accept that and move on. What do you think is the single biggest advance in the field over these last 15, 20 years?
You know, the development of microbiome science really changed this field of probiotics and prebiotics. And it's not that we didn't have great, you know, gut microbiologists in our background, you know, back in the 90s and 2000s, right? I mean, people were really doing, you know, good microbiology, but they were limited with their technologies. So you bring in the whole development of microbiome science and all the omics technologies, and I think that just really was a game changer. Interestingly, though, it's been such a pull, and I've noticed this, you know, with interaction with different companies and everything, that microbiome science just was so sexy to everybody that all of a sudden the shift went from being what can pro and prebiotics do for health to what can pro and prebiotics do for the microbiome. And I've like fought against that for years and years, which is, you know, it's a great question to ask from a mechanistic point of view and all, is let's understand how these substances interact with the microbiome. But at the end of the day, we don't care, you know, what levels of Faecalibacterium we have in our gut or whatever. You know, what we have to do is really look at health benefits in the end. But, I think that whole, it's not any one specific development, but I think that made a big difference to the field as a whole. I think it added the topics to the map. I think that the advances in microbiome science really made people all of a sudden say, well, how do we influence the microbiome? And what were the answers? You know, what was the answer to that? Pro and prebiotic, right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I do think the microbiome science field was so attractive that it kind of blurred the prebiotic and probiotic science, or postbiotic or symbiotic, fermented foods even, because everything, as you say, became around how do probiotics influence the microbiome? And
yeah,
probiotics don't have to influence the microbiome. Now, prebiotics do, but
yeah,
not the microbiome. They only have to influence one thing if that's the thing that brings the benefit. And
right.
Statistically, if people know what the mechanisms are, and Colin and Mary Ellen have done a lot to kind of enunciate what do we know about the mechanisms. But if you actually know a specific mechanism, it's a lot easier from a clinical trial perspective to show that the probiotic acts on this billiard ball, and then that billiard ball hits the other billiard ball that's the ultimate target, which is health. So sometimes just from a feasibility standpoint, sponsors want to show that they can hit the first billiard ball. But as Mary Ellen points out, what really matters is, do you impact health? And you can also have a study where you show that you impact health, and you yet don't know the mechanism. And that's also been an issue where we have a lot of evidence for probiotics working on this, on a health outcome, and there might be different probiotics And if we were clear, if we were certain about the mechanism, we could be confident in pooling the evidence together, but we're not.
Boy, that's really true. Yeah. And not knowing the mechanism really does, it hinders us for sure. But you know, Dan, it's a balancing act, right? Like if you wait around to really understand the mechanism, you'll never get the human trials done. Yeah. And so it's.
And what you care about is how to benefit health. So.
Yeah. But I think we could all say very confidently that there have been some poorly designed clinical trials over the past years that in part could be poorly designed because they were shooting from the hip in terms of trying to understand how all these in vitro preclinical assessments could point potentially to a benefit that you might think a particular probiotic might be able to bring about. But, you know, they missed the mark because they really didn't understand, you know, what was going on in the body. Yeah.
And, you know, over the years, you've worked with and butted heads with, I guess, regulators. Mm-hmm. What's your considered opinion of the role of regulators and how good a job do you think, in this field specifically?
No, I mean, my heart goes out to regulators because I think they have a really, really difficult job. And I think that they, you know, their hands are tied by the regulations as they're written, and they need to, you know, move forward with those. And I think that probably a lot of regulators are regulating products in scientific areas that they don't understand the intricacies of. They don't have the depth of knowledge in the particular field. And so it's a really tough job. I guess I wish they would reach out to the scientists who do know the fields more than they do. And I wish that they could be maybe more forthright in being clear about what the levels and the standards of evidence and what exactly they need in order to feel that they can, you know, authorize a claim, for example, but, you know, based on the particular regulatory framework they have to function under, you know, they need to be more forthright in that. But, and I guess I wish I saw a little bit more consistency, you know. So I think one of the biggest frustrations in the U.S. has been the regulatory acceptance of fecal microbial transplants and comments along that with but is really very limited evidence, you know? I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't save people's lives, but, you know, they seem to be all over letting gastroenterologists, you know, do FMT, but try to get a probiotic claim through that had anything less than, you know, multiple randomized controlled trials when there were so few in the fecal microbial transplant world. I think that's a little bit frustrating. I think
you think some of that is because prebiotics and probiotics essentially their origin is food science.
Right.
And so, you know, food scientists, I guess, don't carry the same kind of weight with regulators as gastroenterologists, psychiatrists. That's probably a barrier we still have to get over at some point. And, you know, until there's a probiotic drug that's approved, maybe we'll always be up against that. But
yeah.
And food, not for medicine.
Right. And I think that the probiotic field has always, you know, had one foot in the food area, food supplement area, and one foot in the medical area. And people have taken foods and they've done drug studies with them. And they haven't jumped through the regulatory hurdles to, you know, do those in the way the drug studies need to be done. And there's just been a lot of disconnect with that. And you're right. I think the origin of that is that many of these probiotics, you know, came from fermented milks. Yeah, I agree.
You know, in addition to being a very serious area of research and literally economically worth millions, if not billions, to industry, it's also been fun. Might sound a bit nerdy to say it's fun, but it really has been. And we've met all over the world. And I remember having sake with you in Tokyo. And I remember watching the midnight sun not touch the horizon in northern Finland. And, you know, we were up in the Colorado Rockies and
yes.
Singapore and so many great places. What's your favorite memory of the outside of the science?
Oh, man, there are just so many. And I mean, I have to say that the reason that it's, you know, so compelling to just make sure you can get to an ISAT meeting is that you just want to reconnect with people that you just have a good time with, you know? I mean, it's just great sitting around, you know, sharing a glass of wine or a glass of sake, as you say, and just chatting and telling stories. Yeah, I don't think I could come up with a single one that necessarily is my favorite. But and of course, we miss Todd so much because Todd was always so good at telling a great story and getting everyone to laugh. And so many people are just
yes, I've been thinking of Todd because of the mention of food scientist and one of the great ones. And he was also such an important figure in each of your careers and for ISAP.
Yeah.
So one of my fond memories is getting to bowl with him in Chicago and finding what a wonderful, you know, he was a very fun person to compete against.
Oh, he was such a competitor. I remember one of Todd's truisms was never let your sports equipment limit you. He always felt you had to get the best of the best because you had to deal with other limitations that you couldn't do anything about.
I wonder, how did you come up with the formula for the ISAP meeting format? I feel like it's my favorite meeting every year, and I always tell colleagues, I love the fact that we get groups together to actually solve problems.
Yep.
But then there are plenaries, and then there are always wonderful activities for the entire group, like bowling together.
Right.
Or playing soccer on the beach in Barcelona.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun one, too, wasn't
it? How did the formula come about? Did you guys feel frustrated by, like, the meetings where you're drinking from a fire hose and just going to all these little short talks and decide, hey, we need to actually have work groups where we spend a lot of time together solving a problem in small, focused groups?
I think that what we were really focused on at the beginning was, keep in mind that back then, like in what, 2002 was our first meeting, there were no, at least in the U.S., there were no probiotic meetings. Like, they didn't exist back then. And I think there were a few in Europe, Colin, that were associated with some EU funding projects. But but there really weren't the kind of conferences on the topic back then. And we really had an opportunity, but we recognized that it was a small group of people, you know, so we weren't looking at a meeting where we were expecting 5,000 people to show up. I think our first meeting had fewer than 70 people. And so the question is you pull these people together in a tight-knit group, and what's the best way to take advantage of having, you know, the meeting of the mind, so to speak. And of course, it was Gregor. Gregor is like the mastermind. His signature strength is coming up with different ways of doing things differently. And he was the one who first suggested the discussion groups. And in fact, he's the one who suggested the late breaking news session as well. That was another one of Gregor's ideas. And so the discussion groups came right from the start. But I think from that early point, we committed to having small meetings. But of course, that's a double-edged sword, because as you know, the board always wrestles with that balance between limiting the size of the meeting so that we can retain that tight-knit group feeling that allows us to, you know, have good networking and all, versus excluding other people who might want to come. And the other big, cost associated with that is ISAP buys a lot of plane tickets to do its meetings. I mean, we bring in about 50 people. That's a lot of plane tickets to buy. But the organization's been committed to making sure we have the right people there and take advantage, as you said, Dan, and putting them together with very topical, problem-focused discussion groups. Yeah.
And the meeting is obviously the most visible part of ISAP. Other than the meeting, there's a lot of activity, and, you know, the board meets regularly, and there's a lot of What's your favorite activity, or what do you think has made the most impact outside of the meeting itself?
Well, I think for me, really telescoping back about ISAP, its crown jewel accomplishment is the reputation it's developed. And I know that it's difficult because we are an industry funded group, but I believe the people who know ISAP and have turned to us, you know, with different issues or problems to help solve, appreciate the fact that we are not an advocacy organization, that we value the science, and yes, we take money from industry to pay for the things that we have to do, but we have an arm's length between the board and the decisions that the organization makes and industry. And frankly, industry appreciates that. I think it's one of the things they value the most about ISAP is that they know they can't come in and say, I want you to say X, Y, Z. And we say, well, how much money are you going to give us to say it? And then we'll do it. I mean, they know that that doesn't happen. And so they know that we can, that when we say something, we stand by what we say, and it's based as best we can on the science. And I think that reputation that ISAP has developed is probably the biggest thing we have going for us. And once people trust you, then you have a vehicle then for being able to say, well, here's some things that we think are important. And then, you know, from that is our interest in developing things like the infographics and the videos to communicate in a science-based way these complicated scientific substances. And, you know, our meetings, we've had great interactions with regulators over the past years where we have said, look, here's what the science says. Here's what the problem is with the way that you guys go about. I know in the U.S. we've had a lot of difficulty with how they used to always require investigational new drug applications before any human research could be done on a probiotic, which was not consistent with the regulations. But since they saw everything through the eyes of a drug, that's how they regulated it. So we've made some movement there. And I think that those kinds of things are very important as well.
Well, you described ICEP as a vehicle, and you've been a very capable captain on that vehicle. What are some of the things you won't miss? You know, like the potholes on the road or the
waves
in the sea.
I mean, I have to tell you, you're organizing the meeting, and I take it very seriously because, again, you're having people coming from all over the world, and you need to make sure you do a good job and that things aren't, you know, left to just fly in the wind, so to speak. It's so many dotting I's and crossing T's, and it's not my signature strength. And it wakes me up at 3 a.m. because I have to think, oh my gosh, I forgot to do, you know, this or that. And so it's always such a relief to have the meeting done with. And I'm glad I won't have to be doing that, because the organization is not the most simple thing. And hats off to people who are better at it than I am.
What do you see as the future of the field? Do you think probiotics will become drugs, that we'll see organisms that, you know, will go way beyond the lactobacilli and bifidobacteria? What do you see as the future?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely going to happen. And I think probiotics will, they're going to get very focused, very mechanistically focused. And they'll figure out what the, you know, what's driving the almost molecule basis delivery of some kind of a health benefit that a live microorganism mediates. I think that will definitely happen. I think on the flip side of it, though, Colin, don't we have like so much fun with thinking about these live dietary microbes, which are almost the flip side of probiotics, where they're not defined. We can't very specifically say that this level of live microbes is necessarily going to do X, Y, Z. But, you know, we're in a situation, I think, where there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that it might be a really good thing to consume these microbes alive through foods. And there's a lot of people who, and they're, and this is a belief, you know, that believe that fermented foods are the best thing to eat and everything. And so there's a lot of science that can happen there to try to narrow down what those might contribute, but it's not going to be in the same way that probiotics can be very specifically defined and sequenced and, you know, known exactly what mechanisms are at play. So I think we're going to see both developments in the future. And I think that's great.
Yeah, I think live dietary microbes really could be a good topic for, you know, one or two more podcasts.
Yeah.
And I think you've done just an amazing service to the field in so many ways. In large, I think, as being a touchstone, someone who the field has coalesced around. And I do worry a little bit about, obviously, nobody is irreplaceable and so on and so on. But I do worry that a bit of the black hole of gravity at the center of the field is, you know, stepping back a little bit. But I hope you're going to stay involved and still there as someone for people to, as a touchstone for this thing.
No, of course. Of course. It would be very sad to just feel like it was completely locked off and I never got to see you guys again. But I can say that, you know, the two of you are two of my absolute favorite ISAP people in existence. So I've always appreciated what you've, you know, the kindnesses you've shown me and the science and statistics that you have like held me by the hand and explained to me, and just the roles that you've played, because it's made a huge difference to me as well as to the organization.